Episode 10, The Tomb. Miss Lucy has joined the undead and is now a vampire. As our story continues, Dr. Van Helsing calls together Dr. Seward, Arthur Holmwood, and Quincy Morris. His plan is to enter the Westenray tomb and bring final rest and eternal peace to Lucy Westenray.
Last night, at a little before 10 o'clock, Arthur and Quincy came into Van Helsing's room. He told us everything that he wanted us to do, but especially addressing himself to Arthur as if all our wills were centered in his.
For there is a grave duty to be done there. And you, Lord Godalming, Arthur, you were doubtless surprised at my letter.
I was. It rather upset me for a bit. There's been so much trouble around my house of late that I could do without any more. I've been curious, too, as to what you mean. Quincy and I talked it over, but the more we talked, the more puzzled we got. Till now, I can say for myself that I'm about up a tree as to any meaning about anything.
I'm a bit confused myself.
Quincy, Arthur, I want your permission to do what I think good this night. It is, I know, much to ask. And when you know what it is I propose to do, you will know, and only then, how much.
That's frank, anyhow. I'll answer the professor. I don't quite see his drift, but I swear he's honest. And that's good enough for me.
Dr. Van Helsing, if you can assure me that what you intend does not violate my honor as a gentleman or my faith as a Christian, I do give my consent. Though for the life of me, I cannot understand what you are driving at.
I accept your limitation. And all I ask of you is that if you feel it necessary to condemn any act of mine, you will first consider it well and be satisfied that it does not violate your reservations.
That is only fair. And now that the poor parlors are over, may I ask what it is we are to do?
I want you to come with me and to come in secret to the churchyard at Kingstead.
Buried?
That is correct.
And when there?
To enter the tomb.
And when in the tomb?
To open the coffin.
This is too much. I am willing to be patient in all things that are reasonable, but in this desecration of the grave.
If I could spare you one pang, my poor friend, God knows I would. But this night, our feet must tread in thorny paths, or later and forever, the feet you love must walk in paths of flame.
Take care, sir, take care.
Would it not be well to hear what I have to say? And then you will at least know the limit of my purpose. Shall I go on?
That's fair enough, Art. Let the man speak his piece.
Miss Lucy is dead, is it not so? Yes. And there can be no wrong to her. But if she be not dead...
What do you mean? Has there been any mistake? Has she been buried alive?
I did not say she was alive. I go no further than to say that she might be undead.
Undead? Not alive? What do you mean? Is this all a nightmare? What is it?
There are mysteries which men can only guess at, which age by age they may solve only in part. Believe me, we are now on the verge of one. But I have not done. I must cut off the head of dead Miss Lucy.
Dr. Van Helsing, you try me too far. What have I done to you that you should torture me so? What did that poor sweet girl do that you should want to cast such dishonor on her grave?
My Lord Godalming, I too have a duty to do. A duty to others. A duty to you. A duty to the dead. And by God, I shall do it. All I ask you now is that you come with me, that you look and listen. And if when later I make the same request, you do not be more eager for its fulfillment even than I am, then I shall hold myself at your disposal to render an account to you when and where you will.
He said this with a very grave, sweet pride, and Arthur was much affected by it. He took the old man's hand and said in a broken voice,
"Oh, it is hard to think of it. And I cannot understand, but at least I shall go with you and wait."
It was just a quarter before 12 o'clock when we got into the churchyard over the low wall. The night was dark, with occasional gleams of moonlight between the rents of the heavy clouds that scudded across the sky. We all kept somehow close together, with Van Helsing slightly in front as he led the way. When we had come close to the tomb, I looked well at Arthur, for I feared that the proximity to a place laden with so sorrowful a memory would upset him, but he bore himself well. I took it that the very mystery of the proceeding was in some way a counteractant to his grief. The professor unlocked the door, and seeing a natural hesitation amongst us for various reasons, solved the difficulty by entering first himself. The rest of us followed, and he closed the door. He then lit a dark lantern and pointed to the coffin. Arthur stepped forward hesitatingly. Van Helsing said to me,
"You were with me yesterday. Was the body of Miss Lucy in that coffin?"
"It was."
"So, Arthur. So, Quincy. Do you hear? Now you shall see."
He took his screwdriver and again took off the lid of the coffin. Arthur looked on, very pale but silent. When the lid was removed, he stepped forward. He evidently did not know that there was a leaden coffin, or at any rate had not thought of it. When he saw the rent in the lid, the blood rushed to his face for an instant, but as quickly fell away again, so that he remained of a ghastly whiteness. He was still silent. Van Helsing forced back the leaden flange, and we all looked in and recoiled. The coffin was empty. For several minutes, no one spoke a word. The silence was broken by Quincy Morris.
"Professor, your word is all I want. I wouldn't ask such a thing ordinarily, but this is a mystery that goes beyond any honor or dishonor. Is this your doing?"
"I swear to you by all that I hold sacred that I have not removed nor touched her. What happened was this. 2 nights ago, my friend Seward and I came here with good purpose, believe me. I opened that coffin, which was then sealed up, and we found it, as now, empty. We then waited and saw something white come through the trees. The next day, we came here in daytime, and she lay there. Did she not, friend John?"
"Yes, it is true."
"That night, we were just in time. One more so small child was missing, and we find it, thank God, unharmed amongst the graves. Yesterday, I came here before sundown, for at sundown, the undead can move. I waited here all the night till the sun rose, but I saw nothing. It was most probable that it was because I had laid over the clamps of those doors garlic, which the undead cannot bear, and other things which they shun. Last night, there was no exodus, So tonight, before the sundown, I took away my garlic and other things. And so it is we find this coffin empty. But bear with me. So far, there is much that is strange. Wait you with me outside, unseen and unheard, and things much stranger are yet to be. So, now to the outside.
Here, Van Helsing shut the dark slide of his lantern. Then he opened the door and we filed out. Each in his own way was solemn and overcome. Arthur was silent and was, I could see, striving to grasp the purpose and the inner meaning of the mystery. I was myself tolerably patient and half inclined again to throw aside doubt and to accept Van Helsing's conclusions. Quincy Morris was phlegmatic in the way of a man who accepts all things and accepts them in a spirit of cool bravery. As to Van Helsing, he was employed in a definite way. First, he took from his bag a mass of what looked like thin, wafer-like biscuit, which was carefully rolled up in a white napkin. Next, he took out a double handful of some whitish stuff, like dough or putty. He crumbled the wafer up fine and worked it into the mass between his hands. This he then took, and rolling it into thin strips, began to lay them into the crevices between the door and its setting in the tomb. I was somewhat puzzled at this, and being close, asked him what it was that he was doing. Arthur and Quincy drew near also, as they too were curious. He answered,
"I am closing the tomb so that the undead may not enter."
"And is that stuff you have put there going to do it?"
"It will. It is the sacred host. I brought it from Amsterdam. I have an indulgence."
There was a long spell of silence. A big, aching void. And then, from the professor, a keen whispered hush. He pointed, and far down the avenue of yews, we saw a white figure advance. A dim, white figure which held something dark at its breast. The figure stopped, and at the moment, a ray of moonlight fell between the masses of driving clouds and showed in startling prominence a dark-haired woman dressed in the cerements of the grave. We could not see the face, for it was bent down over what we saw to be a fair-haired child. There was a pause, and a sharp little cry, such as a child gives in sleep, or a dog as it lies before the fire and dreams. We started forward, but the professor's warning hand kept us back. And then, as we looked, the white figure moved forwards again. It was now near enough for us to see clearly, and the moonlight still held. My own heart grew cold as ice, and I could hear the gasp of Arthur as we recognized the features of Lucy Westenra. Lucy Westenra. But yet, how changed. The sweetness was turned to adamantine, heartless cruelty, and the purity to voluptuous wantonness. The Helsing stepped out, and obedient to his gesture, we all advanced too. The four of us ranged in line before the door of the tomb. Van Helsing raised his lantern and drew the slide. And by the concentrated light that fell on Lucy's face, we could see that the lips were crimson with fresh blood. And that the stream had trickled over her chin and stained the purity of her long death robe. At that moment, the remnant of my love passed into hate and loathing. Had she then to be killed, I could have done it with savage delight. As she looked, her eyes blazed with unholy light, and the face became wreathed with a voluptuous smile. There was a cold-bloodedness in the act which wrung a groan from Arthur. When she advanced to him with outstretched arms and a wanton smile, he fell back and hid his face in his hands. still advanced, however, with a languorous, voluptuous grace.
Come to me, Arthur. Leave those others and come to me. My arms are hungry for you. Come, and we can rest together.
Arthur seemed under a spell. Moving his hands from his face, he opened wide his arms. She was leaping for them when Van Helsing sprang forward and held between them his little golden crucifix. She recoiled from it, and with a suddenly distorted face, full of rage, dashed past him as if to enter the tomb. When, within a foot or two of the door, however, she stopped as if arrested by some irresistible force. Then she turned to Van Helsing, and her face was shown in the clear burst of moonlight.
This is your doing.
I act in the name of God.
Your God is not the master.
Your master cannot help you now. Nosferatu.
Never did I see such baffled malice on a face. And never, I trust, shall such ever be seen again by mortal eyes. The beautiful color became livid. The eyes seemed to throw out sparks of hell fire. The brows were wrinkled as though the folds of the flesh were coils of Medusa's snakes. And the lovely, blood-stained mouth grew to an open square. And her canine teeth, dripping with the child's blood, glistened in the moonlight. And so for full half a minute, which seemed like an eternity, she remained between the lifted crucifix and the sacred closing of her means of entry. Van Helsing broke the silence by asking Arthur,
"Answer me, oh my friend. Am I to proceed in my work?"
"Do as you will, friend. Do as you will. There can be no horror like this ever anymore."
We could hear the click of the closing lantern as Van Helsing held it down. Coming close to the tomb, he began to remove from the chinks some of the sacred emblem which he had placed there. We all looked on in horrified amazement as we saw, when he stood back, the woman with a corporeal body as real at that moment as our own pass in through the interstice where scarce a knife blade could have gone. We all felt a glad sense of relief when we saw the professor calmly restoring the strings of putty to the edges of the door. When this was done, he lifted the child and said,
"Come now, my friends. We can do no more till tomorrow. There is a funeral at noon, so here we shall all come before long after that. The friends of the dead will all be gone by 2, and when the sexton lock the gate, we shall remain. Then, there is more to do, but not like this of tonight. As for this little one, he is not much harm, and by tomorrow night he shall be well. We shall leave him where the police will find him, as on the other night, and then to home."
Arthur and Quincy came home with me, and we tried to cheer each other on the way. We had left the child in safety, and were tired, so we all slept with more or less the reality of sleep. A little before 12 o'clock, we three, Arthur, Quincy Morris, and myself, called for the professor. We got to the churchyard by 1:30 and strolled about, keeping out of official observation, so that when the gravediggers had completed their task and the sexton, under the belief that everyone had gone, had locked the gate, we had the place all to ourselves. Instead of his little black bag, Van Helsing had with him a long leather one, something like a cricketing bag. It was manifestly of fair weight. When we were alone and had heard the last of the footsteps die out up the road, we silently and as if by ordered intention followed the professor to the tomb. He unlocked the door and we entered, closing it behind us. Then he took from his bag the lantern, which he lit, and also two wax candles, which, when lighted, he stuck by melting their own ends on other coffins, so that they might give light sufficient to work by. When he again lifted the lid off Lucy's coffin, we all looked, Arthur trembling like an aspen, and saw that the body lay there in all its death beauty.
Is this really Lucy's body? Or only a demon in her shape?
It is her body, and yet not it. But wait a while, and you shall see her as she was and is.
Van Helsing, with his usual methodicalness, began taking the various contents from his bag and placing them ready for use. First, he took out a soldering iron and some plumbing solder, and then a small oil lamp which gave out, when lit in a corner of the tomb, gas which burned at a fierce heat with a blue flame. Then his operating knives, which he placed to hand. And last, a round wooden stake, some 2.5 or 3 inches thick and about 3 feet long. One end of it was hardened by charring in the fire and was sharpened to a fine point.
The career of this so unhappy dear lady is but just begun. Those children whose blood she suck are not as yet so much the worse. But if she live on undead, more and more they lose their blood, and by her power over them, they come to her. And so she draw their blood with that so wicked mouth. But if she die in truth, then all cease. The tiny wounds of the throat disappear, and they go back to their plays, unknowing ever of what has been. But of the most blessed of all, when this now undead be made to rest as true dead, then the soul of the poor lady whom we love shall again be free. Instead of working wickedness by night and growing more debased in the assimilating of it by day, she shall take her place with the other angels. So that, my friend, it will be a blessed hand for her that shall strike the blow that sets her free. To this, I am willing. But is there none amongst us who has a better right?
Go on. Tell me what I am to do.
Take this stake in your left hand, ready to place the point over the heart, and the hammer in your right. Then, when we begin our prayer, strike in God's name, that so all may be well with the dead that we love, and that the undead pass away.
Arthur took the stake and the hammer, and when once his mind was set on action, his hands never trembled nor even quivered. Van Helsing opened his missal and began to read, and Quincy and I followed as well as we could. Arthur placed the point over the heart. As I looked, I could see its dent in the white flesh.
Pater nos.
Yes, in jail. Sacrifice, gentle man. Patriot regnum. Via voluntas. Libera nos ad malo et omnium nos aratto.
There, in the coffin, lay no longer the foul thing that we had so dreaded and grown to hate, that the work of her destruction was yielded as a privilege to the one best entitled to it.
but Lucy as we had seen her in her life, with a face of unequaled sweetness and purity. True that there were, as we had seen them in life, the traces of care and pain and waste, but these were all dear to us. One and all, we felt that the holy calm that lay like sunshine over the wasted face and form was only an earthly token and symbol of the calm that was to reign forever. Van Helsing came and laid his hand on Arthur's shoulder and said to him,
"And now, my child, you may kiss her. Kiss her dead lips, if you will, as she would have you to, if for her to choose. For she is not a grinning devil now, not any more a foul thing for all eternity. No longer she is the devil's undead. She is God's true dead, whose soul is with him."
Arthur bent and kissed her, and then we sent him and Quincy out of the tomb. The professor and I sawed the top off the stake, leaving the point of it in the body. Then we cut off the head and filled the mouth with garlic. We soldered up the leaden coffin, screwed on the coffin lid, and gathering up our belongings, came away. When the professor locked the door, he gave the key to Arthur.
"Now, my friends, one step of our work is done, one the most harrowing to ourselves. But there remains a greater task, to find out the author of all this, our sorrow, and to stamp him out. Two nights hence, you shall meet with me and dine together at 7 o'clock with friend John. I shall entreat two others, and then I shall have our plans to unfold. Tonight, I leave for Amsterdam, but shall return tomorrow night. And then begins our great quest. There is a terrible task before us, and we must not draw back.